You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fresno readers know the name Diana Markham from her byline in the Fresno Bee. Her long-form journalism brought insight into people's lives with the narrative quality rarely found in newsprint. As her career took her to the LA Times, Markham won a Pulitzer for her coverage of California's great drought. Now she's telling her own story and that of the people of the Azores in a new memoir, The Tenth Island, Finding Joy, Beauty, and Unexpected Love in the Azores. Diana joins us on the phone. Diana, welcome.
Hey, Joe. Good to talk to you again.
This book comes out nationwide on August 1st. Let's start out with your first trip. What brought you to the Azores the first time a few years ago?
I was a local reporter, and a photographer dropped a picture on my desk of a man plowing fields with oxen in Central California, in this time, our time periods, which is how the book starts, with this picture being dropped on my desk. And she said, you know, could you find a story? And I said, yeah, how could there not be a story there? So I ended up going out to Tulare and meeting Marai, who was plowing the fields. And he told me that he was from these islands, the old country. And he told me about the Azores, and it just captured me. He invited us to go to a party, and it was after the story ran, but I went ahead and went to the party anyway and took some friends and discovered this subculture in the Central Valley, you know, these places where it's all people whose parents or grandparents or them came from the Azores. And we went to this barn dance, and there were tablecloths on the walls with pictures of the Azores, and there was Azorean music, and everybody was speaking Portuguese, and there was bull pulls, and it was just like being in this different place, different time, even though I was still in California. And that's where it all started from.
Now, the San Joaquin Valley has a really rich Portuguese-American community, especially in the dairy industry. You mentioned in Tulare County, that's where a lot of people with ancestry from the Azores settled. How rare was it for you to get a chance to go inside the community, to go to one of those festas? These are great traditions, but largely reserved for members just of that community. Was that a difficult process?
Well, that first party I went to was private, but the festas, you know, all spring and all summer, every weekend, somewhere in the Central Valley, there's a Portuguese festa. And, I mean, it's mostly for Portuguese people because that's who know about it, but everybody's welcome. They're very open. Anybody who wanted to go to one of the festas could. And I would suggest that they do. It's really an interesting, you know, piece of this valley.
And how then did you take that in and wind up going to the Azores in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean?
Well, that's kind of the story in the book, but, it wasn't, you know, the high point of my life in that period. I was kind of lost. I just didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't happy at work. Things were bad in the newspaper industry. I was at that period that I think a lot of us go through at a certain age where I just didn't know what I was doing. I took a buyout from the Fresno Bee and I moved to the Azores with this idea that I was going to go be a big-time writer and write a book. And, of course, I fell on my face and it didn't work. And I had to come back and, you know, it was a much longer, slower process than that. But that's how it got started.
Tell me about the place. For many Americans, many people in the Valley, I imagine, don't necessarily have a good idea of what these islands are like.
So the Azores are the tips of nine volcanoes in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. They're about halfway between Lisbon and New York. They sit, like, I mean, literally right in the center of the Atlantic. They're surrounded by the Gulf Stream, so the climate is warmer than you would expect. You know, it's never really cold. It's never really hot. It's always humid. And they're beautiful. They're volcanic. They're green. Black lava rocks, not white sand beaches, not the kind of place that you would think of as resorts, you know, much more rugged than that. I love them. I find them enchanting. They have villages that haven't really changed too much in 400 years. Real traditional houses. Dairy, as you might guess, is one of the main industries, especially on Treseda, which is the island where a lot of the people who live in the Central Valley come from. That's one of the ties, is cows. And yeah, that's the Azores.
There's this great Portuguese word that is one of those that doesn't have a direct equivalent in English called saudade. What does that mean for you?
Well, actually, I define it as best as I can in the book. Let me see. Of course, I have the book in front of me, right? It's this word that can't be translated. They say there's no equivalent in English or any other language. And how I write about it in the book is, it's bigger than homesickness or missing someone. It's a yearning that can be expressed in no other language. It is, as one of Zorian Finn puts it, a strictly Portuguese word. They say it has something to do with death, but mostly life, and maybe the ocean, and probably time. And the only way to understand saudade is to listen to fado, the Portuguese art of the sad song, or more accurately, songs of longing.
Is that the kind of thing that intrigues you as a writer, to take a feeling that is in some way so unique that it doesn't have one word that can convey the same thing, and a challenge for you to put that into your prose?
Well, I mean, as a writer, I'm fascinated by words, but I think it was more than that. I think it was as a human being, just the concept. You know, maybe we don't have the word, but I think the feeling of longing or thinking there's something just out of your reach is a pretty universal feeling.
You mentioned that when you first went to the Azores, you wanted to write this book. Now you have written a book. How different is it than the book you wanted to write?
Well, it turned out to be the book I wanted to write, but a completely different book than I had in mind. You know, I was thinking of something far more traditionally journalism. You know, there was just this interesting diaspora. I've always been interested in immigration. You know, I like stories of immigration because they're about identity and place and our relationship to place and the idea of home, and all of that always fascinated me. But I'm a journalist, so I thought I would write about it third person, you know, following this very unique diaspora. But then when I started writing the book, one of my best friends was reading the chapters, and she used to be the column one editor at LA Times. And I started putting funny little personal stories in. And she said, you know, this is your book. This stuff is your book. And my other editors thought so, and everybody started pushing me to be a little more personal. And once I let go of the idea of it being a more strictly traditional journalism book, I just started having fun and wrote it like a letter to a friend, and, you know, kind of set aside my pride and let everybody get a peek at my goofy life as well as the Zorian story. And that's the book it turned out to be.
How difficult was that for you as a journalist who's, you know, trained, you go to school and you spend years and years writing about other people and not using the first person and intentionally not putting yourself into the story, at least in most circumstances? That's sort of the conventional way it works in this business. How was it to exercise those muscles that maybe you didn't traditionally use in your day job?
You know, I've been asked this a couple of times now, and it was much easier. Journalism's hard. You know, we work under certain, I don't know if you would call them rules, but in journalism, you know, you triple source things. It's not just your own eyes. You ask somebody and somebody else, and you double check. And like, I don't know if there's such a thing as objective, but you're trying to get to some sort of objective truth. This was more like writing a letter to a friend. You know, it would be like if I had a conversation with you and I wanted to write about it to a friend, I would tell it from my point of view and not go to you and say, what do you think of this? So that, I think that's the difference. I've noticed a lot of people are reading the book and commenting on it on Amazon and things like that. And some people are saying that they think it's a mix between fiction and nonfiction. And I think that's because I have a note at the beginning of the book explaining that it's not journalism. And I think that people maybe don't understand the difference between journalism and nonfiction, because this is nonfiction, but it's nonfiction the way I would tell you a story or the way I would write you a letter. It's not nonfiction on the level of craft that journalism requires.
At the same time as you're writing this book, the journalism industry is undergoing an intense period of tumult, one that has been building for years now. I don't know how much you can talk about your current role as a journalist, but just with what's been going on recently with the LA Times new owners, leaving Tronc for a new owner in Southern California, returning local control, what has it been like from the outside, looking back in, seeing what's happened to the industry that you love?
Well, it's so interesting because that turned into one of the running threads of the plot of the book. You know, I'm in the first part of the book, I'm pretty disenchanted. You know, journalism's taking all these hits. There's layoffs all over the country. I take a buyout. You know, in the book, I'm giving a speech to the people who are like family to me, that it's not just about my job. It's about what's happening to journalism in general. And then I don't want to give away everything in the book, but I think everybody knows I end up becoming an LA Times writer, and I talk about how unlikely that was at that time because the LA Times was in bankruptcy and they couldn't hire anyone. So my editors, you know, went to great lengths to find a way to hire me. I mean, the paper was in that much trouble. So I've lived this, you know, I've lived this whole arc. And then, you know, after the book was done, I didn't know if I was going to have a job to come back to. Things were looking very, very grim at the LA Times. I mean, we were bought just days. It came so close in the neck of time. We were owned by a company that was going to lay off, I forget what it is, like a quarter of the staff or more. And that was after all the hits we'd already taken. We were just really in the final throes. And now there's this fresh start and there's this hope, and we'll see.
You mentioned that you like writing about immigration. So many immigrant groups here in the Valley all share similar stories in some way. Maybe one or two waves of immigrants come here, and there's an eventual process of assimilation. That's the American story to some degree. Now, looking back at the Portuguese American community here in the Valley after being in the Azores, do you have a new insight on it and their ability to maintain their traditions and their identity? Has your view on that and your insights into that changed?
I don't know if it changed. It definitely was what caught my attention. You know, I mean, Some cultures find their children very, very Americanized and letting go of their original culture just second or third generation sometimes. And, you know, the Azoreans have been in the Valley for eight generations and they still have these strong cultural traditions, which I find interesting and one of the mysteries that I explore in the book.
Again, we've been talking with Diana Markham today. Her new book called The Tenth Island, Finding Joy, Beauty, and Unexpected Love in the Azores comes out August 1st. Wishing you the best.
Oh, thanks so much, Joe.